The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I need to get that bio changed. Oh, it's always so nice to be in this beautiful center. There's something about the high ceiling, I think, that somehow expands consciousness in some nice way. It's good to see everyone tonight. So I've been reflecting because I went to Sri Lanka for the month of November, and the highlight of the trip, I would say, was getting to meet a very old monk, Sri Lankan monk, who luckily spoke English. That was good. His name was Katakurunde Nyanananda, and he was an early teacher of Bhikkhu Anālayo, who some of you know from his Satipatthana books, but even if you don't. And he was said to be a very advanced practitioner, and I found his presence very powerful. This is the highlight of a one-month trip, and I was with him for about 5 minutes because he had pretty severe health problems, and you speak with him very briefly, and then the monks that tend to him move you along so the next person can come in. And the reason I'm reflecting particularly is that he died about a month ago, and so, you know, I really saw him fairly close to the end of his life and won't have another chance to see him. And so I feel very grateful to have had 5 minutes with this being. And I thought I'd say something a little bit about his teachings today, also expanding to include other sources. One thing that interested me about Venerable Nyanananda is that he is considered something of a heretic. He's called the heretic sage, actually. And this is just relative to the fact that the monastic sangha there is fairly conservative, and he had different views. He would give teachings that weren't quite in accordance with the way the Dharma was supposed to be understood according to that lineage. And, you know, in the U.S., you almost can't be a Dharma teacher unless you have some unique thing that you present as your thing. But there, it feels like the opposite. So, I can't say I'm an expert on all of his teachings, but I've read some of his books, and I took a course on some of his material also, 3-month course last year. And I can say that a strong theme that runs through his teachings is to look at the role of concepts in our experience, to look at how we project onto our world, how we get caught up in ideas of things, how we misperceive the way things are. And, you know, down to a very deep level. We know about this in our surface level interactions and life also, but he insisted that this is actually a manifestation at the surface level of something very deep and fundamental. And he was adamant also that the things that we think there are, like books and water bottles and so forth, are really only ideas, you know, created out of the flux by delusion. And so he advocated dropping the notion of independent self-existing objects as the path to liberation. And this is also, of course, the act of understanding emptiness. Now, don't worry if you're getting worried. This is not a complex philosophical talk at all. In fact, what Nyanananda talked about can be seen from quite everyday ideas and experiences, and he often used very simple analogies. So I wanted to share a little bit from this book of his called The Magic of the Mind. Of course, it's about the creation of things by the mind. If you're interested in his books, by the way, they're all online at www.seeingthroughthenet.net. And many of them are in English, have been translated into English. So there's this scene. it's a prologue to the book, where there's other stuff in the book, but this prologue he gives is kind of a scene of a magic show. I'll just read part of it. So, the famous magician whose miraculous performances you have thoroughly enjoyed on many an occasion is back again in your town. The news of his arrival has spread far and wide, and eager crowds are now making for the large hall where he is due to perform today. You, too, buy a ticket and manage to enter the hall. There is already a scramble for seats, but you are not keen on securing one, for you have entered with a different purpose in mind. You have had a bright idea to outwit the magician, to play a trick on him yourself. So you cut your way through the thronging crowds and stealthily creep into some concealed corner of the stage. The magician enters the stage through the dark curtains, clad in his pitchy black suit. Black boxes containing his secret stock in trade are also now on the stage. The performance starts, and from your point of vantage, you watch. And as you watch, with sharp eyes, every movement of the magician, you now begin to discover, one after the other, the secrets behind those breathtaking miracles of your favorite magician. The hidden holes and false bottoms in his magic boxes, the counterfeits and secret pockets, the hidden strings and buttons that are pulled and pressed under the cover of the frantic waving of his magic wand. Very soon, you see through his bag of wily tricks so well that you are able to discover his next surprise well in advance. Since you can now anticipate his surprises, they no longer surprise you. It no longer kindles your imagination as it used to do in the past. The magician's hocus-pocus and abracadabra and his magic wand now suggest nothing to you. So the whole affair has turned out to be empty in a certain way. And so you turn away for a moment to take a peek at the audience below. And what a sight! A sea of craned necks, eyes that gaze in blind admiration, mouths that gape in dumb appreciation, the ahs and ohs and whistles of speechless amazement. How is it, you wonder, that I have been deceived for so long by the way these magicians work? So the show ends, and crowds are now making for the exit. You two slip out of your hiding place unseen and mingle with them. Once outside, you spot a friend of yours whom you know as a keen admirer of this magician. Not wishing to embarrass him with news of your unusual experience, you try to avoid him, but you are too late. Soon you find yourself listening to a vivid commentary on the magic performance. Your friend is now reliving these moments of the bliss of ignorance which he had just been enjoying. But before long, he discovers that you are more mild today and wonders how you could be so after such a marvelous show. Why, you were in the same hall all this time, weren't you? Yes, I was. Then were you sleeping? Oh, no. You weren't watching closely, I suppose. No, I was watching it all right. Maybe I was watching too closely. You say you were watching, but you don't seem to have seen the show. No, I saw it. In fact, I saw it so well that I missed the show. And then it goes on. That's the prologue, so you get the scene. So as you might have started to discern, this is about, the way we get so caught up in life, right? And the way things are, and we think we're seeing a certain way, and then it takes this turn, right? And we think, oh, cool, we're going to see through the tricks. But the effect of that is that it's not magic anymore. And so there's this, what sometimes goes on when people read this is they have a little bit of a mixed response. There's the sense of, yeah, I want to see how the tricks work. That would be really cool. And then it's like, oh. But then there isn't the excitement. And there's this concern, oh, is this, because this is a lot of the back of a lot of people's minds, is Dharma practice going to make me boring? Am I going to turn into just this bland, empty, non-self, that doesn't have any excitement or passion or interest? And so I like the way this kind of brings all those elements out. You get to see all those emotions going on. But what's interesting, right, is that the people who are with the craned necks and the gaping mouths, they were choosing to be deceived. That's the other subtext. You know, to what degree are we choosing to be deceived by the flow of life? So I'm going to leave all that kind of unresolved and go forth from there with some of these ideas. So also, I guess this is the day for honoring people who have died, because I want to quote from Stephen Hawking also, who died last Wednesday. He said, "The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it is the illusion of knowledge." I thought that was interesting. Now, of course, in Buddhism we do say that ignorance is the fundamental cause of suffering, but they're not actually different, because when Stephen Hawking's talking about ignorance, he's probably meaning the Western notion, which is stupidity in some sense. But in Buddhism, ignorance is the illusion of knowledge. Actually, that's what the Buddha was referring to, is there's a little bit of willfulness to what's called avijja in our tradition. So this takes us into the realm of our perceptions and our views. You know, what is it that we're perceiving? What is it that we're receiving from through our senses? And how are we seeing that? And what does it mean to us? So what Jnanananda advocated, along with quite a few other teachers, was to consider our views as something to practice with, the same way that we practice to develop mindfulness or loving kindness or equanimity, whatever it is that you're practicing with. We can also experiment with different ways of seeing as a practice. And there's a lovely quote from the Dzogchen tradition, "Trust your experience, but keep refining your views." This is delightful in that sometimes if we play with views, we can get sucked into the idea that, oh, it's all a dream, it doesn't really matter, everything is meaningless because we can change the way we see it. But that's not the case, and we're expected to trust our experience. You're still, you know, you see, you hear, you have thoughts. These are to be used in your practice. You are an agent, you're intelligent, you can use those, but keep refining your view. You know, don't think that what you see now and understand now is the final story. Let that also be open to something that can evolve through your practice. There are a lot of ways and levels to play with views as a practice. I would guess that actually all of you have done this in some way. This is not some obscure, surprising thing that I'm talking about, because at a very conventional level, we have the notion of what's often called reframing our experience. Has anyone heard of this? Yeah, I see some nods. So this is often done in, for example, psychotherapy. One of the modes that might be used is you come in and you say, well, I have these issues and this situation and here's how I feel about it. And the therapist says, well, let's see if we can reframe that a little bit and, you know, look at it in a different way. It's a very healthy thing to do. Probably we all do it naturally to some degree and then maybe need help in some of the cases where we're very attached. So this is particularly useful, this idea of reframing, just seeing differently, thinking differently, basically, in cases where we don't have a lot of control over our situation. I want to tell a little story about this from my family. I had an uncle who was Japanese, and his family was such, it had three brothers, and he was the youngest. And his oldest brother was born in Japan, and then his parents came here to Seattle, and the middle brother and him were born here. So they were American citizens, and the oldest brother was a Japanese citizen. And then World War II happened, and the oldest brother was drafted into the Japanese army, and the middle brother was drafted into the American army. And as if that weren't enough cognitive dissonance for the family to hold, the parents and my uncle, who was a teenager too young to be drafted, were sent to one of the internment camps as a potential threat to domestic security. So, you know, these are situations where reframing is relevant. Interestingly, my uncle, well, one more detail is that while he was there, he developed a rare eye degenerative eye disease and went blind as a teenager, was blind for the rest of his life. He died a few years ago, and I can honestly say that he was one of the happiest people I knew. He really had a gift for seeing the best in situations, for always turning it in some way. He wasn't a meditator, but he could have been. Turning it into something that he could work with, essentially. So this is very much an art and a skill. And even for us, on a more, maybe more mundane level, we can say if someone is angry, maybe that person's having a hard day. Maybe they just found out that, you know, somebody close to them has an illness or something, and now they're angry with me because they're having this difficulty. Or, more personally, we could maybe see a loss as an opportunity. You know, we've maybe played with that in our minds, because we've all had losses of various kinds. A related practice in the realm of reframing, thinking differently, is to observe and to change our languaging. Our words reveal many views. You know, sometimes we say something and the person that we're talking to says, "What exactly did you mean by that word?" And we realize, oh, you know, that's actually a very charged word. I didn't know that I was seeing the situation that way until I spoke about it that way. So noticing what we say can be a revelation of our hidden views, and then we can also deliberately change our language in order to affect our views, right? Also views about ourselves. So here's one I use, and I want to invite you're trying it out. Sometimes I view myself as the agent of other people's good karma. So what do I mean by this? You know, like, for example, if I'm helping somebody in some way, it could be about I'm a generous person, or I'm compassionate, I'm feeling love, I want to help this person. And then it's kind of like from my framework, and that's fine, that may be true enough. But what about this other person is having a lucky day? They are having some good karma ripen. And when good karma ripens, that means that beneficial things happen to you. We've all had that experience. And so if I'm the agent, if I'm willing to be the agent of that, it might be that I'm here to help that person because their good karma is ripening. And I can see myself as being fortunate enough to be nearby to be chosen as the agent of that. So it's not that one of these views or the other is the right way or better or something, but it can be a very helpful way to think. It actually takes all the self out of the temptation to see myself as a helpful person or something else. So see if that works. The great thing about when you start to play with views and kind of, you know, reframe and see how you can do things is that you get this skill in sort of using one view at this moment, and then in the next situation that might not be the right way, and so you learn to see it in a different way. The gauge is, of course, whether how much suffering there is, right? If a particular view is bringing suffering, see if we can find one that wouldn't bring as much suffering. And if you're deluding yourself by just kind of Pollyannish positive thinking, you'll find soon enough that that brings suffering. So, you know, this actually has its own built-in check that, you know, you won't just sugarcoat everything to try to create a positive frame of mind. So all of this is really good, and it's actually very rich practice. I very much encourage flexibility of viewpoint and of perception in this realm of thinking and language. It can be very liberating in cases where we're caught, for sure. But I would suggest that the Buddha invites us to be a lot more radical with that, you know, with the way that we look at things. Reframing is actually not talked about that much in the suttas. A little bit. I think you could find examples of it. But much more often, he talks more about what I'm going to talk about next. If we look a little bit deeper from just that kind of way that we're framing a situation, we see that we carry many, many unquestioned views, kind of at the next level down. not just about other people, but say about the existence of certain things, or the solidity or the inherent reality of the way things are, or about our own nature, who we are as a being, as a self. There's a lot going on there. And these more subtle views are a lot of what the Buddha was trying to warn us about. They invite dukkha at deep and subtle levels that can't be addressed by thinking differently, including using different language. So reframing essentially only goes so far. Once you open actually to the enormous number of views and perceptions that we carry, we can see how wide the range really is. So consider now this idea of insight. That's technically the name of our meditation tradition, right? This is the insight tradition. So we should have some sense of what it is. We might think often that insight is that momentary flash of understanding where we were able to see something in a completely different way, and it might affect our life in a small way or in a really big way. Surely everybody in this room has had some kind of insight throughout their practice, because they tend to come like within the first couple of sittings. Usually the first insight people have is that their mind is a lot crazier than they thought it was. That's a genuine insight, actually. And then there may have been others after that. But consider also if whether or not insight might be something that we can practice also. And I think it's intended to be a practice. There are particular insight ways of looking. And that's kind of why this is called the insight tradition, is that we're cultivating ways of seeing that will uproot the deepest levels of suffering, of dukkha, in our minds. And most likely we're going to have to cultivate insight. It's probably not adequate to only let go, only change our thinking. There's going to have to be some deliberate looking in certain ways. And so then you might get a sense, especially if we start seeing the incredible number of ways that you could view any situation, well, where do I start? We're not just randomly changing our views and trying out just sort of different things. Actually, how we do it is important, and which views we look at. We can't just do it any old way. But don't worry, the Buddha gave us ways of looking that will actually unfold a path toward freedom. And they may sound familiar once I start talking about them, but I'm approaching from this slightly different way in order to help us see that our way of seeing is in fact a way of practice. So what are these various insight modes of seeing? Actually, even here there are multiple views, right? I kind of gave this view like, okay, you deliberately choose to see in these insight ways, but that's only one way of seeing it. You could also say that this way of seeing deeper and deeper into how things work unfolds naturally. It's like, water flowing downhill. But even there's probably some need for training and guidance in order that we don't get in our own way and we actually are able to allow this natural unfolding to happen. So whether you think of it as something that you're doing or something that is unfolding but you have to get out of the way, either way, we need a little bit of structure and some guidance. So I'll talk about these insight ways of seeing that we can cultivate. They're called anicca, dukkha, and anatta. You may have heard of them as the three characteristics, but originally they were called the three perceptions, the three sanyas. And then I'm going to include a fourth one too, just because. So anicca means impermanence or inconstancy. And it's hard to overemphasize seeing that things change. Now you might say, well, that's the simplest one, and it is in a sense. But it's very important to continually notice that things arise and pass, they change, they shift, they develop, they rise, they fall, they decay. All these change words. And yet, nonetheless, we go through our day thinking, blah, 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 everything's the same. My coffee, my car, my job. But it's not. Everything's changing. We really want to reify things. I was just on a retreat where one of the retreatants is herself quite a seasoned teacher. That was impressive. And she asked the monk leading the retreat, if seeing impermanence is necessary for liberation. You'd think she would know, but it was a great question. It was very precise. You know, is this? And so he knew that she's a teacher and so forth. So he answered in an interesting way. He said there must be at least one moment of observing impermanence to be liberated. So there you go. If you've already seen, if you've already done at least one, you've fulfilled the requirement to some degree. But most of us are probably going to need more than that. 10 or 20 million. So that this is interesting, right? If it's considered a complete necessity, you know, what if you get it right down to it, what's necessary to see for liberation? One of them is impermanence. So that's good. I would say the other is dependence, and we're going to get to that dependency, how things. But at least one is impermanence. So that's always a good thing, a good lens to apply, if you will, is to notice the arising and passing. And like if you use the breath as your meditation object, great, the breath is a very changing object and you can flow along with it. And you can know that even in that simple, you know, the very first thing you're taught, if it's often, is to pay attention to the breath, that is a very deep practice, actually. You're training your mind in a mode of seeing that will lead to important insights. The second word that I said was dukkha, and that is sometimes translated as suffering. I even said that a few minutes ago. But I think a better word is probably unsatisfactoriness. And this is, it can often be seen as arising from impermanence. If everything is impermanent, changing, nothing's going to last forever and ever, then it can't be satisfactory. Nothing can be ultimately satisfactory. And at first we may be a little bit discouraged by this, but of course the changing nature of things means that there's always something new that we can find. There's always a path. There's always something that's, you can't get stuck, basically. But the flip side is neither can you rest on your laurels forever, right? So how do we practice dukkha? Does that make sense? It does, actually. You could see it from anicca, as I just said, from impermanence as kind of a reflection. You know, oh, this is impermanent, therefore I shouldn't rely on it for my ultimate happiness. Or I have practiced myself for a long time with a bodily and mental tension, which is an expression of dukkha, because when there's dukkha, when there's clinging, right? Clinging and dukkha are synonymous, simultaneous. And so if you sit and you notice that your shoulders are tight, well, there's something going on there. And so if we have a continual practice of easing, softening, relaxing, both in the body and in the way the mind gets caught on things, that is basically working with dukkha. You may not have conceived of it that way, perceived of it that way, but here's a good way to view that practice, is that that's a practice of noticing and releasing dukkha. Also very, very deep, because eventually the idea is we're going to release all the dukkha. So any level we do it at, we're practicing something quite fundamental. So an insight way of seeing is to see where's the tension and how could that be opened to, let go, released, softened, all of those words. And this can be also quite an artful practice. I had a period in my practice where when I started practice, I was just a ball of tension. So this has been a great practice for me. And there was a period near the beginning for about 2 years where, I mean, I did other things in my practice, but a fairly big part of my practice was to notice where I was contacting surfaces. So, you know, the chair, the floor, the table, whatever I was touching, and check if I was actually in a relaxed posture relative to that surface. So often I was kind of trying to lift myself away from it, trying not to bracing against it, or trying not to quite contact it. Very interesting to see that tendency in my mind to kind of, you know, not want to make complete contact. And that is, you know, that's a form of dukkha. It's aversion, essentially. All right, so the third insight way of seeing, I said, was anatta, and that means not self or non-self. And this is one that's hard to understand often. I won't go into it in great detail because I'm going to talk about emptiness as the fourth, and it's related to that. But there is a way to see not self as arising also out of impermanence. Maybe that's why impermanence is so fundamental, is that it can really lead to the other two. This is a quote from Nyingma Rinpoche, talking about his own practice. Gradually I began to realize how feeble and transitory the thoughts and emotions that had troubled me for years actually were, and how fixating on small problems had turned them into big ones. Just by sitting quietly and observing how rapidly, and in many ways illogically, my thoughts and emotions came and went, I began to realize in a direct way that they weren't nearly as solid or real as they appeared to be. So this is using the impermanence of thoughts and emotions to realize that they're not as substantial as we try to make them, and that insubstantiality is part of what not-self is about. You know, it's about there isn't a permanent fixed entity that you can call you. I'm not intending to prove that tonight. But there are also ways to begin working with the self view directly. It doesn't have to arise necessarily out of impermanence. So that opens a whole other space. You know, how else could we work with this? So this puts us right into the realm that was championed by Nyanananda of emptiness. And so emptiness, yeah, is broader than anatta, I would say. I'll note that it does have different meanings in different Buddhist traditions, and I'm definitely not going to get entangled in philosophy and find differences between different strands of Buddhist tradition. But I want to frame emptiness basically as saying that it's integral to the study of dependence, of how things depend on each other, which is how they arise, how do they arise and pass away. Okay, so you observe impermanence, things come and go, great. But the next level is to say, what are the conditions for that to arise? And what are the conditions for that to cease? And what are the conditions that are present simultaneously with something being there? That's a little bit finer level of detail, and this is what emptiness starts to point out. We start to see how interrelated everything is. So this is a quote from Rob Berbea, a teacher from England. It turns out that whenever there is any experience at all, there is always a way of looking also. And sooner or later, we come to realize that perhaps the most fundamental fact about any experience is that it depends on the way of looking. That is to say, it is empty. Are you surprised by that use of the word empty at the end? Because I know emptiness isn't a very popular word in America sometimes. So let me read that again. The most fundamental fact about any experience is that it depends on the way of looking. That is to say, it is empty. So it's interesting, right, is that he's saying, and we can see this surely at some level for ourselves, is that literally what we experience depends on how we view it, right? If you walk into a meeting and your frame going in is, this is going to be horrible, you know, this is going to be really painful, it's an hour and a half, it's going to be, you know, blah, 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 a lot of people sharing a bunch of different ideas and never agreeing. You'll probably have that experience, you know. Whereas if you go in and say, this is going to be really interesting, even if it's still a bunch of people kind of blah, 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 sharing about something and not coming to an agreement, it could be, you know, I'm going to watch what emotions people seem to be having today, or I'm going to watch who speaks the most or what order they do. I'm going to watch I'm going to watch the facial expressions of everybody else while this person is speaking. You know, there's all kinds of other ways to frame it, and you may come out saying, that was a fascinating lesson in human culture, you know? And you might have also learned some things about your colleagues, right? Or something. Or it could be a mindfulness exercise. I'm going to sit and observe my own body. I'm going to watch when I get tense, when I relax, when I'm willing to speak, when I don't want to speak. You know, and you might learn a lot about yourself and how you're relating to that situation. So literally the experience that we have depends very much on our framework, not only ahead of time, like the example I gave, but in real time, how we're watching things unfold. So this is a way of saying that things are empty. They aren't a specific way. They depend on how we engage with them. And of course, after that meeting, somebody else may have had a totally different view. You know, we've had that experience also. So we're invited to use this way of looking as a practice and to start to realize to what degree we can affect our own experience by our view. This opens a tremendous amount of freedom in our practice, right? Because we don't have necessarily that much control over the conditions that we're in the meeting with our boss and there's a bunch of people expressing their opinions. But are you therefore absolutely resigned to having a lousy morning of unwholesome, irritating, unpleasant mind states? No. We could view it in some other way. And then, you know, as I pointed out, this could go deeper. But this is a practice of emptiness. So let's see what we have time for. I'll give one example of everyday emptiness that's very easy to see. The emptiness of countries, right? So, and this is useful because it's not that they don't exist, but they're empty of inherent existence. It's a little slight difference, right? So here we are, we're in the United States. I don't know that everyone in this room is a citizen of the United States, but it doesn't matter, we're living here. We're all living here. But the United States, which I can say as a concept, and everybody knows vaguely what I'm referring to, didn't exist a few centuries ago. It just didn't exist. And it was created, right? It was put together by humans, fabricated. This is probably a good thing. This is not an argument for not having countries or an argument for having countries. It's just an observation that this was something that was put together. And even now, it's not like it was put together once and therefore that's it forever. It's actually, its existence is dependent on the fact that a lot of people believe that it exists and act like it does and, you know, work in ways that affirm that every day. And absolutely, if, you know, 300 million people all decided that the United States didn't exist, it wouldn't. It couldn't. So I guarantee you, though, you should still take your passport when you go and things like that. You know, it's like, and there are laws and other things. So this is not what I'm advocating. But this is just, you know, once you see that, do you see then that maybe it's a little bit lighter than we thought? I mean, I gave that example earlier of wars, right? Japan and the United States went to war, for example. And it was very real. You know, people died. And so our grasping onto ideas and concepts as real has real consequences to it. Or our rejection of them would also have real consequences. But you see there's a realm of how we're participating in things by how we see them, what reality we ascribe to them. And this has a lot to do with our suffering, is how strongly we ascribe reality to them. And of course it changes. Like we can even see with our self view that there are times when we don't feel that strongly like ourself. You know, it's like we're just doing our thing or we're relaxing or we're going for a hike or something. It's not all about, you know, this. But there are other times where somebody threatens us or falsely accuses us and suddenly, you know, it's like, you know, there's this self there and it's, I didn't do this, I said this, or we're angry. And so, you know, this sort of the amount of grasping onto the self creates a lot more solidity about it in certain situations compared to others, right? And so starting to observe, where is it thick and heavy? What are the conditions that bring that about? Where is it lighter? How could that be played with? So I have a lot of faith that when the heart starts seeing like this and starts seeing how things are made and unmade, we can trust that it will move toward less and less dukkha. I think the heart wants to go. I'm on the side of this is a natural process, but we get in the way of it because we don't understand, basically, how to allow that to unfold. So I don't think we have to do the understanding that that grasping causes suffering and that things aren't as solid as we think. But we do have to do the act of seeing that way, of accepting that we're going to have to shift our views on some things. This can be hard because what we really want is to be enlightened without actually changing all the good things about our life in some way. And eventually we start to see this is not possible, that there's going to have to be some fundamental shifts. Otherwise, we'd already be enlightened. So, you know, but it's a process. It's a process. And I guarantee you that you won't, first of all, you won't lose responsibility for your life. You're not going to become unable to care for yourself and not care about your loved ones if you stop believing that the self is so solid. Also, ultimately what we're letting go of is the causes of suffering. That's the second noble truth. The causes of suffering are to be abandoned. So who wouldn't want to let go of that? So we also worry that we're going to let go of our deepest values and that all of our friends and relatives. No, we're letting go of the causes of suffering. Let's be clear on that. But it may cause some changes around all those other things also. But the process can happen, and the lightening is very good. So speaking of that, I want to return to Venerable Jnanananda. This is from an article written by somebody who went and had a chance to go and talk with him for an extended period earlier in his life from another monk named Venerable Yogananda. And so he asked Jnanananda, what would one see if one looks at the world objectively, if such a thing were possible? Sunyata, comes the quick reply. Sunyata means emptiness. So the first thing Jnanananda said was emptiness. And then Jnanananda goes on. Whether people accept it or not, the truth is emptiness. Thingness gives way to emptiness. Imagine that there were a large box here with a label saying that the contents weigh 1,000 kilograms. If I were to ask you to move it, you'd object, saying that it's too heavy for one person to handle. Let's say I somehow coax you to try. When you try to lift, it comes off almost without effort. There's no bottom to the box. The 1,000-kilogram sign was deceiving you. That's why the realization of the Dhamma is equated to the laying down of a burden. So things are not so heavy. Everything has this label on it that says 1,000 kilograms, and so we say, I can't do that, I can't do that. But maybe, maybe there's no bottom. So I encourage playing with views and perceptions as a very fundamental part of practice, and following down this path, how light could it get? How else could it be seen? How else could it be seen through? It bears great fruit. Thank you. If there are any questions or comments, you could leave that on. We're right at time, so if you need to leave, go ahead. But if anyone has anything. All right.